Welcome to Australian Design Radio, a podcast seeking to provide Australia and the world with conversations and commentary on design.
This episode is recorded on Yagar and Turrbal country, and we acknowledge traditional owners, their enduring connections to the land, knowledge and stories, paying respect to their elders past and present. I'm your host, Grace Poynton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Amani Thassam. So, Amani, we're reaching the end of our TDC 2023 series. What did you think of it?
I think it went really well. There were a lot of firsts. We trialed a new designer on designer format for some episodes, which brought out some really interesting conversations.
Yeah, they all felt very fly on the wall, which I found quite interesting listening back as I've been editing. Big kudos to Matt for showing us the ropes. And of course, a big thank you to another Matt, Matthew Haynes, for giving us the opportunity to record these at the design conference. Speaking of which, in this episode, we interview Bonnie, Christine and Ahmed from NYCHA, who spoke at last year's conference. They chat a lot about their process and their team dynamic as a digital product agency based in Sydney. It was super interesting to see how the areas of design, technology, commercialization and strategy come together and collaborate so well. I think that's always been the dream, to have that interdisciplinary relationship be so intrinsic to how your business operates.
Yeah, this is a space we both work in, so I personally loved getting to sit in on this episode and interview the team. But enough about us, let's actually get into this episode.
We hope you enjoy this one.
Thank you all for joining us. We have NYCHA here, Ahmed, Christine and Bonnie. Wanted to start off with the different, because you know, you're speaking about the different disciplines. How do you kind of balance that with your work and how do you collaborate?
It's very difficult.
Great difficult.
Constant battle.
Yeah. We did mention yesterday that in a perfect world, the three disciplines work very well in harmony, but it's kind of rare that that happens.
I think it's, you know, the three disciplines that we have, it's hard to, when we're in a room discussing price, I think it's very hard for us to, how do we divvy this up? You know, how much strategy do we have to do? How much creative, how much design, how much technology we have to achieve in all of this. And so breaking that down into equal measure parts is very difficult because there's always sometimes an imbalance that we find. And so we don't have a fight, but you know, it's a challenge. Bon and I will go back and forth and say, how much user testing do we have to do here? Or how much user research do we have to do before we can get to an insight, before I can go and take that away and move that into some UX thinking and some prototyping. And so there's you know, breaking down that cost with what you have to play with is quite difficult. And Chris helps balance that out, given that she has the data on all side over 6 years that we've collected at NYCHA. So sometimes she actually can pull out of her head faster than one and I can
pretty
discuss.
Good like
get
that.
It right most of the time.
It does actually, yeah. So Chris and Bon and I will go back and forth. Oh, you know, Bon will, I need a week to do this. I need a couple of days of this. Measure my results, etc. And then I'll say, I need my technical specs to be this, etc. We'll have all the hours, and Chris will already have the answer in her head. And then
I'll already have done it.
Bon and I will write a number up, and Chris like will take a unfold a piece of paper and.
And yeah. Surprise, and they
number.
Match.
She's a bit of a magician in that department.
It's interesting as well because clients don't often want to pay for strategy. So that's something that's a bit of a battle. I think what I said yesterday as well around, you know, design without strategy is decoration. And it doesn't mean that the strategy needs to be incredibly complex or it doesn't need to take months, but there is an element that needs to guide then the work that Ahmed takes over in moving it into UX and UI and an idea that really resonates with the audience. And I think that's the important thing as well, is you're stepping into the shoes of your target audience. And it doesn't have to be in an intense period, but the, you know, more and more we're trying to get clients to understand the value that strategy can bring.
And have you found that, I know, over the years they've been getting better at like understanding what strategy is? And
I think we're getting better at working with clients that appreciate and see the value in that.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. We do have to take our clients on an educational piece a lot of the time to help them understand that at the beginning. And that's part of, you know, we don't pitch, but that's part of our process to onboard a client, essentially, which is taking them through why we know that research needs to be done, why the user testing at certain points in the journeys that we create needs to be done and retested. We can't have assumptions, essentially. Yeah. It's too dangerous when we're dealing with clients like Lifeline, but those clients obviously know they have clinical researchers and they have a lot of their processes that we work quite hand to hand with. So some of our clients, of course, know those steps. The ones who, you know, as Bond mentioned, maybe think they know more than they know, or that we have to kind of just guide a little bit.
Or when they're very subjective. I think design is very, very tricky because it is so subjective. And, you know, when you work with clients and, oh, I don't like that color, or I don't like this, or I find that hard to read. But then we're not actually building the product for you. We're building it for their target audience.
And how do you go about getting, because you mentioned a lot about user research, do you just have partners? Do you get people in the room and test the prototypes?
Yep.
Bond does a lot of that.
Yeah, we work with recruiters usually, or sometimes it will depend, as Ahmed said, Lifeline, reach out. They will generally have their own user database that we will work with. It's obviously a sensitive topic, so we will work with people who have passed a certain scale as well. There's a certain satisfaction with life score you need to pass before you actually go into testing with vulnerable groups of people. But for other things, it might be existing database of people who use the product. It might be totally new people if we want to understand if they would use the product. Generally I will do that either in person or online, and that's my favourite part of my job, really.
Yeah, I mean, well, Bond will find, you know, in an upfront strategy, we'll understand the audience, the segments, and then we'll meet each one of those and say if each person is understanding the product as we believe they would be. It's funny what the insights do come back with when you think that menu button is so simple.
Again, you think, you make a lot of assumptions.
I guess we're very much in that world, so we just think, oh, we can break convention here sometimes, which we love to do. I love breaking convention.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, for me, it's fun. It's it makes us think differently. And, but of course, it's a core, breaking UX conventions is challenging for users. And it's how do you do it in a way that still allows the product to be accessible, but also a little bit more fun as well, a bit more delightful than your usual experiences. And that's where we really take the care and craft to make sure that we're meeting a bit of fun UX and fun design,
mm-hmm.
but not crossing the barriers too far, essentially.
Mm, that's really interesting you mentioned that, because I was thinking yesterday you mentioned like WebGL and all the cool interactive stuff. How do you test that as well with the users for accessibility? And
we do, yeah. Well, we don't put too much WebGL in our work. That's a fun one. That engine was set up to lead us into another bigger piece, hopefully in the future. And so that was a foundational piece. But when we put it in a 3D engine, we also make sure it's very accessible from not just an SEO and accessibility point of view. Yeah, so everything is still readable by metadata as well. So, we don't remove alt tags. There's still readability. You can still do things. So if you strip away the engine, you still get left with the core pieces of what the web is supposed to be accessible. But I think the world is moving quite fast. Obviously, we're moving into a 3D space,
mm-hmm.
with what's coming out.
Apple
world, yep. Which is taking the next level. And I think for us, it's just moving, making sure we're moving with the times of technology to understand, right, how do we make this more accessible? How do we take this piece of technology and start with it with the foundational element and try and move it along in a way that is going to work almost seamlessly? You don't know there's a 3D engine behind it, but it's there to help give the experience a different point of view than you're normally going to achieve with a 2D world. And I guess why you do that is there's certain subtlety factors, I guess. We pick our moments. We don't chuck 3D into everything. Right now it's something that we, I guess with the WebGL stuff, we've been using it for like shader technology and things like that, where it's providing some transition animation effect that can't be done in normal ways. But our new kind of foundation for using a 3D engine is how can you dive deeper information, expand worlds, or pull information out in a deeper sense. And I think that's where we're looking to kind of look at the new UX paradigms, essentially.
Yeah, cool. And like kind of on that topic, do you ever have clients who come to you being like seeing your previous work and being like, we want AR or this or that, but it might not be suitable for them?
Yeah, it's funny. It's AR is not a new technology. I've been playing with it for 10 years, I think. It comes back and forth, doesn't it, the technology. It's always about the experience, like what are we trying to achieve? And so that goes back to strategy. Clients will always come to us with, we want to create an app. And we're like, okay, well, let's take a step back, or we want to create a website. But it might be then they actually need an app.
Yeah. Yeah. Is that the right thing? What's the problem that you're actually trying to solve? Mm-hmm. And that's, as we said, strategy is as much about uncovering the problems as finding the solutions. So we do always try to go back a step and break down that brief of what they're actually asking us to do, and then also what does the user actually want, because they can sometimes be two very different things.
Yeah, it's a funny thing. It actually goes back to the commercials, because when the brief comes in and it's, you know, a big budget to create an app experience, and we all think, actually, this is probably the wrong solution. You need a smaller budget and it could be this. But is that you know, I guess it's like, are we taking away the commercial aspect of what we do? But it's right for the user, so this is what we should suggest that you do. So we do get times like that where we actually go back and say, I think the problem statement's wrong here. Obviously, we have to do a bit of research before we really unpack that. But we don't always go in guns blazing.
Yeah, and I guess that kind of scenario gives the client trust, right? Because you're like, actually, you don't need to spend this much. You can achieve the same result.
It goes back to Bonnie's point from yesterday, which is we're not really here to sell. We're here to help solve problems. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you frame your functions of the relationship in that manner, then everything that you do is just trying to help.
Yep.
And then all the guards are down.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're delivering results because you're solving the right problems. And it's a win-win for everybody.
And that's why we try to work with clients where we believe in the problems that they're trying to solve as well.
You know, what's powerful is that you do get, when you work with Nigel, you get the three of us very solidly working on the work and talking quite honestly with clients hand in hand. So, you know, there's a good conversation that happens essentially across the table, and that leads to the best results.
Yeah, and they probably appreciate having like all points of views when they're talking to you.
Yeah, right?
The Holy Trinity.
At different points in time in the project, it's usually me up front, and then I have a few check-ins as we go, and then it's quite heavy with Bon at the beginning of the project with Ahmed feeding in, and then Ahmed kind of taking the lead towards the end and seeing it through to the bitter finish.
Yeah, the end of a project is and always just the hardest.
Ahmed, well, not for Ahmed. Ahmed loves for it. Projects to continue on, even when they're supposed
they're never
to be
finished.
Finished.
They're never finished.
Yep.
Never,
just can't never help finished. Myself. I think there's.
We know.
I mean, I was talking to this actually with Sam, who's our new design director, and we work in such a fun industry. I think it's a very. We're very lucky, I think, to work in this industry for sure. You know, we get to outsee our passions, and I think that's amazing. I enjoy design and technology so much, and so does everyone on our team, that we could talk about it for days.
Mm-hmm.
So when
and you definitely do,
and we do, we go back and
Ahmed
forth.
Ahmed loves design,
and so it's a joy almost. And so even when you're trying to solve the hardest problems at the end of the project, it's still fun. Because there's a challenge there, and you're trying to solve it. And I guess maybe that goes back to my coder background, it's design too. But it's
also just that endless kind of passion to delivering perfection.
Yeah, and you know, as everyone I'm sure is aware in the design world, you put your baby out there, and you know, there's little details that you just want to go back and fix, and you can't help yourself, and you think about it day and night, and like, why am I obsessing over this? It's just let it just drift
can't
away
can't help
a bit.
It can't help it you're hardwired that way.
It's hard to let go once you give it to clients, and if you see them change things
that too
happens a bit with our products.
That's funny, isn't it? You love something so much, and then you have to let it grow, right? You have to let it become its own thing. It's the wild. And with digital, it's on a printout, it can change so much over time. We put that trust into our clients, and
And we try to work a lot with like brand, you know, brand systems and direction for content and imagery. And so we really do try to create a system that will live on for years and still look fantastic and be doing the brand justice.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any ways of like training the client, like in, when you're handing over, how do you kind of
definitely
set them up?
We actually don't really have that much. It's not that complicated.
We do work in sprints.
Oh, yes, but in terms of understanding the systems, and a lot of that onboarding is done progressively throughout the, as Ahmed was alluding to, throughout the sprints of the engineering phase. So by the time they're ready to hit the launch button, they're familiar with everything.
We also try and work in their mental model how they'd like it set up. And that way, when they're in the system, they can make decisions at, for example, if we're in a two-week
talking about the CMS, when we put together the CMS.
Yeah, how they manage content, how they'd see the taxonomy of the system. So if they would like it set up in a certain way, we can do that for them. And because we do work in these kind of sprint cycles and we show reviews of the work, ongoing progress, they get to feedback on it and say, actually, could we change this and move this into this bucket here? And I don't like the way, I find this confusing. So at those early stages, they're able to kind of feedback, and then we're able to make changes in the system on the back end for them so that they have clarity and understand the product themselves ongoing. And it's almost like they're helping craft how they would work in their organization too. So that helps them immensely instead of, as Chris is saying, just handing over the reins at the end, because after about, you know, say it's a six-week cycle, at the end of that, they're very familiar with the product. We've also got full documentation that we do as well within the system. Everything's quite... We try and make everything not just the UX for the front end, it's the back end too. So that's another thing that we really put a huge emphasis on. And our engineering
understanding
team,
all of the stakeholders up front as well and all of their needs, because in a large organization or even smaller ones, everyone will have different needs and different functions and different objectives of their role too.
Yes, for sure. I think a lot of people sometimes forget like the biggest users of the websites are the admins, right? Like they're constantly...
Completely. That's the number one problem statement we have in our briefs. It's that our content editors find this CMS hard to use. They're getting lost and plugins are going wild and they have no idea how to change content. So from the onset of when Nightjar started, that is the number one problem statement we have in the briefs that we have, and that's where we hopefully come in and solve that for them. It really is to alleviate pain points. It's one of our foundational clients was the Iconic, and we, with the system we put in place, the Iconic, it improved their efficiencies by 88%. So
oh wow, that's
it was yeah. We were brought in to help change their model from their old stack, which was purely a catalog essentially. They had no way of putting content into their website. So we came up with a new way to make an inflexible system flexible.
Because they wanted to keep people basically in the funnel for longer. So rather than just being, that was the original problem, was that rather just being a very transactional catalog site, how do they engage people with content around fashion, around lifestyle, that can then keep them engaged on site longer.
Yeah, and so their marketing teams have to work very closely with development teams who they have 50 to 100 developers at a time, but they're all working on keeping the site running, and it's a behemoth, so as you can imagine. And so they don't have time to be building campaign pages, category pages. And so our job was to come in and reinvent or re-energize that tech stack, where we could inject content into their 7-year-old stack, which was no hard feat, but we managed to accomplish it, which is... We were shocked if we accomplished it, and they're very strict on, you know, every millisecond on the Iconic is...
Obviously, I mean, they're a $1 billion company, so that's, you know, millisecond is, revenue. Yeah.
Yeah, so the design of that system is extremely articulate. We had to... There's 100% unit testing in the code we had to write. There was each module had to really... be as its most optimal, so designing them for speed was crucial. And it kind of redefined how they created content at the Iconic, and we set it up so that you could merge putting in content and syncing with their catalog API so that you could overlay hotspots on images and shop the look, for example.
And Chris and I can attest that when we were testing the product, it worked very well. The whole shop the look, add to cart, we did a lot more shopping than we had intended.
We both checked out at the same time with some new shoes while we were testing.
You have to test it properly, right?
Exactly. Got to do the whole flow through the checkout.
Yeah. And the product arrived, so that was good too.
And that, I mean, but that kind of, that then allowed the development teams to concentrate on what they were working on, which is, you know, optimized checkout flows and really trying to rework their infrastructure to Kubernetes at the time. And so the marketing team would then just use our system to just spin up new categories like kids, designer hub, sneaker hub, and take that forward without any other team members. So
it used to run through 7 teams or something. It would take 4 weeks, and we reduced that down to a couple of hours.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like, you don't think, I guess you don't think of that when you look at the website, like, as a user, you're like, oh, yeah, like, I'm just buying myself. There's a checkout.
That's it.
And that's exactly the way it should be. Yeah. It's invisible.
Yeah. True creative value is real transformation. And so whilst, as I was saying, you know, we have a bit of glitz on the top of it, that's where we have the fun. But at the heart of it is really solving the business problems, making their teams more efficient, freeing up space for people to do their jobs more efficiently. And I think that's where the power comes, is where technology can make that change. Mm-hmm. And good design principles just are core to what we love at Nightjar anyway.
What a great episode to finish the series on.
I'm a little sad that it's already over, but we're working on more content for this year, so we'll be bringing you new episodes soon.
In the meantime, for anyone who's based in Brisbane, you might be interested in ADR's latest edition, ADR plus BNE. It's a local events chapter that we've started, and we have our first event, a panel on responsible design, coming up in a few weeks.
But don't worry if you're not in Brisbane. You can still follow ADR on socials and stay up to date with all our latest episodes and content.
We'd love to hear what you think. Tell us what you liked, what you'd like more of, or who you'd like us to interview. Drop us a line at hello@ozdesignradio.com.
And perhaps even leave us a 5-star review while you're at it.
We would very much appreciate it. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time.
See ya.